I will invite Patricia and Lawrence to come up and speak, just by way of introduction. Patricia Berry is new business origination actuary at Swiss Re. She specialises in the development of non-traditional reinsurance solutions, including longevity swaps, structured reinsurance and alternative distribution. She's been with Swiss Re for 12 years and prior to that worked with a number of other organisations, including Girling Global, Oceanic and AMP in a range of actuarial roles. Lawrence is Director and Senior Products Actuary at Swiss Re in the Asia Pacific. He's responsible for developing and costing life and health reinsurance products with a particular focus on longevity and health risks. He has co-authored a number of papers on critical illness, TPD, experience in Australia and New Zealand, and also various papers for the East Asian Actuarial Conferences. He's been with Swiss Re since 1997 and has worked in Australia, Switzerland, Singapore and Hong Kong. So first of all, I'd like to welcome Patricia to come and speak.
Okay, thanks, Tony. Good morning, everyone. There's a third author to this paper. I wanted to give due credit to him, and he's Gavin Jones, but he can't make it to this conference this time. Just quickly, by way of setting the scene, as Tony said, we had the very encouraging recommendations from the Henry Report. Now, we know that the government is not going to provide annuities themselves, so at the very least, is the right environment for lots of product development in terms of, by way of longevity risk protection. So we do expect to see in the coming months and years, to see very much the next generation of retirement income products incorporating longevity risk protection in them. So the starting point of us writing the paper was that, if you were the actuary having to allow for longevity risk assumptions as part of your product development and you have limited time frame, what would you do? Given the data that's around or the lack of it, what would you do? What sort of information you would look at? What sort of considerations you would make? So we thought we might share with you some of our thoughts in this aspect. And this is how we start off wanting to write a paper. And we started to find some interesting things in the modelling aspect. So Lawrence will talk about that. In the next 25 minutes or so, there'll be very much two parts to our talk. I'll cover the first half. Lawrence will do the second half. I'm going to talk about the sort of considerations that you will make in terms of setting the base mortality for post-retirement ages. We'll quickly look at the population experience, and then we'll look at mortality experiences of subgroups like the pensioners and annuitants overseas and locally. Then Lawrence will talk about the future mortality modelling. He's going to talk about something like the three broad forecasting methods. We're going to fit three chosen models to some Australian population data, and then we'll look at the historical mortality improvements as well as the extrapolated projected mortality improvements from the model. And then lastly, Lawrence will talk about the sources of uncertainty stemming from the choice of model, the choice of your parameters, and also the statistical variation too. And he's going to touch on the implications on the right level of capital. Right, so in terms of population experience, we took the raw mortality rates, MXs, from human mortality database for various countries. And then we calculated the period life expectancy at age 65. Now, the bold dark line is Australia, and then you have the light blue, the UK down the bottom, and Japan is the brown one up the top, and a few other countries in between. It's quite interesting to see that Australia now is very much at the top. This is, this is up to the latest data available in the Human Mortality Database. You see that back in the 1960s, Australia is very much down the bottom of the pack, and now we're very much up the top. So, you know, the Australian population mortality improvements have been greater than some of the other developed countries. So that's quite interesting. It's very much by the order of, say, 2.5 months per annum on average for the last, say, 15, 20 years for Australia. The other point is, it is the mortality improvements was relatively flat before the 1970s. But then the improvement has been increasing quite rapidly since then. Two obvious possible explanations, reduction in smoking in the 1970s. Bernard Salt talked about the education of smoking and non-smoking, and also medical advances in the area of cardiovascular diseases especially. Now, this is the equivalent graphs for the female populations. 2 points, the improvements more lean and fashion compared to the male, and the growth is not as rapid as the males. But nevertheless, female life expectancy has been increasing still on average, something like 1.9 months per annum, so it's still very rapid. One reason as to why the improvement is not as rapid as the males up to date is possibly because the smoking, reduction in smoking and the cardiovascular diseases are relatively less relevant for females. One other point that I want to make is that these calculations are based on what we call period life expectancy. So we are allowing for the mortality rates post age 65 as we see them now. These life expectancies have not incorporated the future mortality improvements. So if you allow for future mortality improvements, you could easily add another, say, 2 years to the life expectancies that you're seeing. So sometimes if you see the life headline life expectancies from ABS, etc., that it can be quite misleading because they haven't really allowed for future mortality improvements. So apart from the population experience, so what happens to the mortality experience by way of different social economic classes? This is the UK experience. Now, it's from ONS, Office for National Statistics. What they do is that they've done a quite interesting study, a longitudinal study. So from the early 1970s, they took 1% sample of the England and Wales population and tracked their mortality experience. Another interesting point is that at the start of the study, they actually look at the occupation of the person or occupation of the spouse or parents and categorize each person into different various economic class. So it's a bit like our disability income occupation class. So we don't have similar studies in Australia. So it's a very interesting study and very much just confirming our suspicions that of mortality is linked to socioeconomic class. If you look at the end bit, the difference in life expectancy for the top class and the bottom is about 4 years. Now, 4 years difference in life expectancy by our calculation equates to something like 10% difference in a typical cost of annuity amount. So, and the other point is that the gap between the top class and the bottom class seems to be widening over time too. So that's another interesting point to note. ONS also publishes life expectancies by what they call local authority. So it's a bit like our postcode. So again, the life expectancies between the top postcode and then the bottom of the postcode is something like a whopping difference of 10 years. Now, 10 years equates to something like 20 or 30% of the cost of a typical annuity, lifetime annuity. So it's a big difference. So now we can see that in the UK, they sell lifetime annuities and vary the pricing by postcode. Just depending on the postcode in which you live in, the price can vary by something like up to 4%. So it's just interesting to see. Now, are we going to see similar studies in Australia? I don't know. I would expect that we'll see if we're going to do similar studies, that I would expect to see differences by regions in which you live in Australia. But probably our postcode, a person would think that our postcode is too small to define the differences, but maybe by regions, not necessarily postcode. Now, what about the annuitant experience? Just looking at UK first, CMI Continuous Mortality Investigation regularly produces report and experience studies. It's a very useful an area for reports and looking up experiences. They produce a series of graduated tables within the life office experience by different groups of annuitants and pensioners. I very much just, in a way, randomly chose one group to illustrate here, and this group did have quite a large sample size, or what they call normal life office pensioners. Fairly intuitive stuff. You expect the experience to be lower than 100%. And then also, in the early years post-retirement, you expect the experience to be better than the later years. Possible reasons, because they've just finished their employment, so it's the employment natural selection. And also, we are talking about life office annuitants, pensioners, so we are talking about people with larger pension annuity amounts, and also probably the more educated ones that are more prepared to shop around. So it's the self-selection impact coming through. Now, in our paper, we also cover another study by the CMS for what they call self-administered pension schemes. So there's a separate study, and in there, the mortality experience are higher than what we see here. Again, we suspect that it's because it just shows you the extent of the self-selection. The self-administered pension schemes tend to have a more diverse range of occupations and social class, the more passive pensioners in there. Okay, switching to the US. SOA also publishes annuity experience reports. The one that we were looking at had experience up to 2004. Is a voluntary market for annuities. Now, the good thing with that report is that it comes with a pivot table, so you can cut and slice the results in whatever way you like. What we did was to look at the experience by two types of the annuities. One is called non-refund, the other one is refund. So it's similar to one with a surrender value option, one without. And then, as expected, you see the blue line, the one without the surrender value, that people must have a more positive outlook to their life expectancy to choose the one without the surrender value, and it shows up in the experience. I'm not showing up the female equivalent graphs, but again, it shows you similar stories. So what about Australian experience? We have very much limited experience compared to the UK and US and some other developed countries. Two years ago, at this forum, Martin Stevenson and Ann Wilson produced a paper looking at the experience of the public sector pensioners. So that's relevant there. The comforting things to know is that the shape that appeared in that report is quite similar to the UK and Newton shape in terms of the pensioners' experience, mortality experience versus population. Again, sort of lower in the early retirement ages and then rising up towards the population level at the older ages. Probably the only difference is that in the public sector scheme, we saw the experience above 100% of the population at the much older ages. But that one there, you've got to also allow for the fact that the sample size is very small and not necessarily statistically valid. The other source of information that we could think of was our own institute's mortality investigation. The latest one I could find was the one up for experience up to 1999. Why the sample size is nowhere near as big as the UK and the US one, it's still a material one. Again, the reassuring thing is to see is that the shape is quite similar to what we observed overseas for annuitants and pensioners. But a bit flatter. It's in our report. It's between 60 to 80% of population. So before I hand over to Lawrence, just quickly to recap the few points. Australian post-retirement life expectancy has been growing very fast, possibly slightly more so than some other developed countries. In terms of key predictors for longevity, the social economic class is a big one, and that includes items like postcode and benefit amounts, the size of your of the annuity amount. Other factors, including purchasing behavior, and also things like employment status. And then also we saw widened gaps between the top and the bottom socioeconomic classes. Now, all this stuff you may think are pretty obvious, pretty intuitive. I guess what we wanted to show you is to give you an idea of the degree of differences between groups, between mortality and the subgroups. And sometimes the degree of difference can well exceed your planned profit margins if you are going to price, say, a lifetime annuities. Another point is, again, all this data, you can download them from the web. But I guess for time poor people like you, that if you were going to set some longevity assumptions and with unlimited time frame, we wanted just to give you some points of reference in terms of, something that might be the relevant experience for you. So I hand over to Lawrence. He's going to talk about the second half of the task of setting longevity assumptions, and that is, setting your future mortality improvement factors.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Patricia. So Patricia's covered, the current picture. So what is our starting point? What should annuitant mortality look like today? What I'm going to talk a bit more about is what the future holds. And, in some ways, the future is rather more unpredictable than the present. I think there's quite a lot of data to help you come up with some assumptions about what the current period of annuitants might experience in terms of mortality. There's considerably more difficulty if you're going to now try and predict what's going to happen to annuitants in the future. So in our paper, we talk briefly about three broad methods for mortality modelling or mortality trend modelling, improvement modelling. The first one, extrapolation, I guess is probably the one that's most, maybe not familiar, but comes most naturally to actuaries. You have a lot of data, you have some numbers, you use that, you use the past to predict the future. But I guess one thing we want to highlight is that it's far from the only method, and we shouldn't pretend that us actuaries with our mathematical models and techniques have a monopoly on being able to predict longevity. There are sort of explanatory or process-based models, and these are more than just taking the past data and extrapolating the future, trying to come up with a good explanation for why you think future trends in mortality will be the way they are. And often that's done by, for example, an example of those would be models that try to project mortality by cause. So maybe they split into heart disease and cancer and other diseases, and then try to make a prediction of those separately and aggregate that together to come up with overall mortality projections for the future. And a third area, I guess, is maybe an area that's a little bit less familiar to actuaries, comes a little less naturally, just by talking to people like biologists, geneticists, and things like that. I guess it doesn't give you a very clear picture of what's going to happen in the future, but it gives you an idea of the range of possibilities that could happen. So biologists who can tell you about sort of cell degeneration, the process of aging, the medical advances that may be popping up in the medium term or the long term, to arrest some of these the aging process, and you know what the future might hold, and how this may affect insurance companies or other companies offering longevity risk products. So this chart is a sort of a colourful and interesting representation of the past history of mortality improvement in Australia. This is it's taken from a website called the Human Mortality Database, which in turn takes data from the ABS. It's the website just happens to be a convenient source. I think if you tried to get the data from the ABS, it would be a little bit more difficult. But the website's got Australian data and various other countries' data, and is, you know, in a readily accessible form. So what the heat map represents, the colours on the heat map represent, so the along the horizontal axis you have the year, along the vertical axis you have the age of people, and the colours represent the level of mortality improvement. So the more red the colours means higher improvement, the green colours means deterioration, actually. So the darker red colours represent big, higher improvement, the lighter colours represent lower improvement. And I guess the two key things I think want to get out of this slide is that I suppose there are a few different drivers for mortality improvement. So one is maybe age. So there is some difference in mortality improvement by age. In general, as you get towards the very old ages, mortality improvement tends to slow down. There are also what we call period effects. So then there are certain periods where you get sort of vertical bars, which are maybe certain years where mortality improvement has increased more rapidly, and certain years where mortality improvement has been lower. And one thing about mortality improvement tends to be auto-regressive over periods. So you may get one year where there's a really bad flu, wipes out some people who have a weaker immune system. The next year, the people who are remaining tend to be sort of healthier, built up some immunity, so maybe mortality is a bit better in the following year. So there are sort of some patterns over time that you get these periods of high mortality improvement followed by periods of less mortality improvement and so on. And so one thing someone suggested is that these things happen with quite a lot of regularity. So one possible explanation for that may be that it's just that Australia does a census every 5 years, and maybe every 5 years they correct the population. We had a quick look at that just to see if that was causing problems, but I mean the population seems to progress pretty smoothly. There are no sudden jumps in the population at sort of various census dates. The other effect, which maybe it's a little bit less clear on this chart, but it's clearer than on most, is you get some of these diagonal effects. And what these are what we call cohort effects. So there may be a group of people born in a particular year or particular set of years who just seem to have much higher mortality improvement than elsewhere. And if you look in our paper, we got a few different charts for the UK and the US as well. The UK has a very, very, very clear cohort effect. Like here, the Australian one is a little bit less clear, but it's still, once you've seen the US, the UK chart, when you look for the same thing on the Australian chart, you see a very similar thing. We've got a US chart as well. The US is less, even less clear than the Australian chart. It seems to be a weaker cohort effect than the Australian chart. And this cohort, this diagonal here, is what corresponds. So if you've read some of the UK literature on mortality improvement, corresponds to what they call the super cohort in the US and in the UK, concentrated around people born in the early 1930s, and there are various theories as to why these people have better mortality improvement than everyone else. So one theory is that they're the generation who missed the Great Depression. They were born at the sort of tail end of the Great Depression, but they were too young to go to World War II. And they're probably the first generation to enjoy the benefits of the National Health Service in the UK, although that doesn't really explain why Australia has the same cohort effect. And another explanation that has come up more recently is that it's the generation following the uptake of smoking. So it's the generation that, there were smokers, but this first generation where there's a big decline in the rate of people smoking over time. And there's a recent UK paper which tries to explain just the whole cohort effect in terms of smoking prevalence. This is the same chart for females, which is a bit less interesting. You still see the period effects. The cohort effects are less obvious. I know it's maybe a bit more debatable as to whether there is a cohort there. But what we've done in the paper is really use the male improvement chart to do our modelling, just because it gives a bit more, the results are a bit more interesting in that you got these period effects and these cohort effects as well. So what we've looked at as a starting point is just to look at a few different models of mortality. Now, these are all extrapolation models, so they're basically models that take the historical data, fit something to the historical data, and then try to extrapolate that into the future. And each of the models, okay, you don't have to understand the mathematics too much, but each of the models has like an age effect, so what I've called A and all these things. The third model has an implied age effect because of the way this legit formula is formulated. If you want to know more about, there's more about it in the paper, but I won't really dwell on that. So there's an age effect. There are period effects, which are these like P terms or the R terms, period effects, and then there are cohort effects. So basically, they're just models constructed out of, they have some sort of predefined structure, which incorporates one or more factors for age, one or more factors for period effects, and one or more factors for cohort effects. And some of them will have interactions between age effects and period effects, and interactions between period effects and cohort effects, and so on. Significance of the models, the Lee Carter model is probably the best known of these mortality models, but as I'll show, it doesn't work very well, I guess, for Australia. But this is, Lee Carter model has been used for a lot of mortality modelling around the world, especially in the US. This Curry age period cohort model, I suppose, hasn't been used a lot, but it's a simple intuitive model and it has three terms, age period cohort effects, all independent of one another. And this last model, the Cairns-Blake-Dowd model, is just another model, I think, that's been developed more recently, which I suppose in some ways it's just developed that way because it seems to fit better to the data and seems to give quite reasonable results. So this is the Lee Carter model. The clearest thing on the Lee Carter model is it has no cohort effects. It doesn't project any cohort effects. It just projects that mortality will vary by, mortality improvement will happen over over time, and it varies by age. So there's no cohorts, just improvement rates vary by age. The Curry age period cohort model looks like this. So you see that this is the past data to the left, and then this is the projection in the future. It starts to resemble what the chart I showed you earlier, which is the raw data. And then these are the projections it makes in the future. So it picks up that there's a cohort here and projects this cohort into the future. Another interesting sidebar is that it seems to project, from the past data, it seems to project like a cohort of, like if this is the super cohort, this is the not-so-super cohort. It seems to project that there's a cohort of people who have mortality deterioration. Now, it's not clear, a better understanding of the cause of this deterioration may give you a better sense of whether this is something that will continue in the future. For example, if it's like a road accident getting worse or something like that, maybe that's not something that continues in the future. But we haven't really looked into that yet. And the third model looks a little bit similar. It's the Cairns-Blake-Dowd model with the cohort effect. Again, it projects a cohort effect. It sort of trails off a bit more. So this one has a bit of a weaker cohort effect, and it tends to diminish over time. But part of the idea of this paper and presentation is just give you a sense of that there are different models. They may be equally plausible. They give different results. And if there's one thing we've learned from the global financial crisis is that never ignore the possibility that your model is wrong. Okay, so in terms of the implications of what these models imply in terms of mortality improvement, so if you project over the period 2007 to 2025, this chart gives you an idea of what sort of mortality improvements for males are projected. So if you look at the Lee Carter model, M1 model, Lee Carter model looks like what probably a lot of Australian insurance companies use for their future mortality projection. So at age 65, you've got a fairly high rate of mortality improvement, and then as you get older, you've got lower and lower mortality improvements. And it's similar to what is written into the solvency regulations in terms of what the mortality improvements in solvency regulations are. But the Lee Carter model, what it ignores is this cohort effect. And the cohort effect is basically, this is like a vertical cross-section of the heat maps you saw before. So the cohort effect is this peak and then come back down again in terms of mortality improvement. So this area of, these people who are 75 to 80, these are the super cohort who tend to have higher mortality improvement than those surrounding it. So depending on the other models, so the M3 model is the Curry APC model, and the M6 model is the Cairns-Blake-Dowd model. They have slightly different improvement profiles. The Curry model has a stronger cohort effect. The Cairns-Blake-Dowd model has a weaker cohort effect. Now, the other thing I just wanted to highlight is we did some, confidence intervals around the models. So just using historical period volatility and coming up with a sort of 1% percentile and 99 percentiles based on historical volatility of those models using a sort of autoregressive moving average kind of process. And I suppose the key thing to note is that depending on your model choice, one model may be outside the 98% confidence interval of another model. So just to highlight again that you do have these quite big variations in future improvement projections depending on which model you use. Yeah, this is just another way of looking at the same thing. If you've got 100 people at age 65, depending on which model you choose, you get quite different results in terms of how many people survive over time. just quickly wrap it up now. So this chart is really just to give you a sense of what sort of variability you can get in your future mortality improvements depending on a few things. So this is sort of representing model risk. So different models give you different answers, and the differences between different models can be quite significant. So, okay, even if you... So for this particular chart, this zero line represents the standard Curry APC model, which is the M3 model, this zero line. The M6 model for an annuity for a person age 65, 3%, so 3% may be like an indexed, sort of close to a real interest rate. The M6 model will give you a difference of maybe 6 or 7%. The M1 model, which doesn't have a cohort effect, gives you a bigger difference. And you get around about the same order of magnitude for model risk for a male aged 80, for example. Parameter risk, what we looked at is if you, instead of taking the period from 1960, instead of fitting the data to the period from 1961 to 2007, you fit the data to 1992 to 2007, so taking the more recent data and just fitting the model to more recent data, you get a little bit of variation, but not a lot. The statistical volatility can be quite big, so depending on your confidence interval for an annuity may be anywhere plus or minus sort of 8 to 10%. And the last, these things are just to give you some benchmarks for what does that mean compared to like a standard sensitivity. So if you shift the mortality curve down by 10%, which is this 90% of M3, you get about 3% variation at age 65, 4% variation at age 80. So then this is sort of the order of magnitude of capital adequacy in Australia. So capital adequacy in Australia is between 8, so low margin is about 10%, high margin about 20%. So this is the sort of shock test you get on capital adequacy. So in the range of, so about this to double this, about 3 to 6%. 4 to 8% is the range of capital adequacy, and you can see that some of these other errors are easily within that range. And another maybe common test that people do, or common sensitivity people do, what if mortality improvement was 1% higher than what we assumed? That gives a slightly bigger sensitivity at age 65 and at age 80 than just a 10% shock. So, just to wrap up our sort of formal presentation before we move on to questions, in terms of, so if we go back to our original question, is how would you price longevity risk? So what we've tried to illustrate here is that there isn't really a single answer, and I suppose not having a single answer is good for actuaries, because if there were a single answer, probably wouldn't need us to do much. But I think you can only really arrive at an informed answer by using a combination of methods. You may look at some extrapolation techniques. You may look at some explanation techniques to see if your results are reasonable. You may look at some expert opinion just to, again, to have this sort of reasonableness check on your sense check on your results. Is what you're predicting really within the bounds of reason? One other thing we'd highlight is that especially for males, not so much for females, there is in Australia strong evidence of a cohort effect. So the types of mortality improvement factors that companies have used in the past where they just vary by age is potentially understating mortality improvement for the future quite significantly. As I highlighted, similarly plausible models can give you quite different answers. So it's always important to bear in mind that the model may not be right. But what we'd advocate really is somewhere within all of this variability, you have to if you're going to price a longevity product, you have to make a decision on what you actually think your best estimate is. But it's important to understand, I suppose as actuaries, it's important to understand the variability around that. One thing about longevity is it's a risk that doesn't really diversify. So as you write, So in terms of mortality trend, as you write more and more longevity risk, you just get more and more mortality trend risk because the whole portfolio moves along the same trend. It's not something that sort of diversifies between the portfolio. So it is something where it's necessary, you know, make an informed choice as to how you set your assumptions. Okay. Oh, I did have a conclusion. Sorry, I did have a conclusion slide, but I think I've already said most of that, so we'll just move on.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Patricia and Lawrence. So we're now going to open up the floor to questions. We do have a roving mic. The session is being recorded, so if you could please speak into the mic, identify yourself, speak clearly, all the usual things, that would be appreciated. Do we have any questions or comments? Do I have to call somebody out? Wonderful. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks. That's a really interesting paper. I thank you for doing that work. You mentioned about the issues of variability by postcode. We've just done a preliminary study looking at variation by region and socioeconomic factors. And if you wanted to look at the results, there's a paper on the UNSW Working Paper website. It's by Andy Tang, one of my students, and myself. And it just shows variation by geographical region, as you would expect. And what it also shows is that, you know, wealthier people tend to live together in the same sorts of areas, and Indigenous live in certain areas, and high unemployment relates to certain areas and so on. So what turns out is if you use postcode, for example, or the equivalent, that actually proxies for socioeconomic factors. And you can, if you don't have the information, you may be able to use a geographical factor. And that's what they do in the postcode underwriting in the UK. So that's an interesting thing. The cohort thing's interesting as well. We've been looking at cause of death data and modelling cause of death data. And that's where you see the cohort effect coming through, because some causes actually have very strong cohort effects, whereas, you know, things like accidents and so on, you don't see it. And there have been changes in mixes. So I think that's an interesting thing to look at, particularly when you start looking at projecting. And I'm glad that you did point out the importance of the cohort effect, because when you look at the cause of death data, we looked across 9 countries, and if you use models with cohort effects, they perform much better than those with just age and period effects. So there's a very strong cohort effect across lots of causes and across lots of countries, and to ignore it means you don't have a really good model. But this is really interesting stuff, and I congratulate the authors on that.
Is this on? Yeah. Oh, just one more comment about the use of annuity pricing by postcode. Then, of course, you know, the obvious effect is that if one company starts doing that, then almost the other company is going to follow through. Otherwise, you know, that company will pick out all the impaired lives, living all the very healthy lives. Then you're going to almost have to adjust your pricing to suit. So, yeah, we'll see whether, you know, save in a number of years' time, whether we'll do that or not in Australia. I guess it depends on the availability of data.
Actually, just to make a comment on that, I suppose one concern I had, I mean, besides the selection and people going and getting an investment property somewhere to get a better annuity rate, whether postcode can lead to indirect discrimination under the Racial Discrimination Act, which doesn't have an insurance carve-out. But anyway, there you go. Keep out for that one. There was another question, I think, Mike.
Hi, I'm Mike Thornton from EXA. Congratulations on a very well-written paper. I found it a very easy read, which wasn't my expectation going into the paper. It certainly highlights the difficulty in terms of striking best estimate assumptions. But I guess, given the volatility wide range of potential outcomes, what do you think the implications are for profitability hurdles from a product development perspective?
Yes, In the paper, we touched on the implications of this variability in terms of the right level of capital that should sit behind the longevity risk. I guess at the end of the day, you know, we don't have a strong definitive view of what should be the correct pricing basis, if you like, for longevity risk. One thing that I suggest that we really should pay attention to is to do sensitivity analysis to make sure that for a possible range of future outcome, you know, would you still be financially okay in terms of, you know, sort of premiums exceeding your future benefit outcomes. You've got to allow for the possible variability and test the implications on capital when you do the pricing. But we tend to look at just a whole lot of sensitivity analysis. You know, if you've got this base mortality wrong by 5-10%, what would that do to your bottom line? If you've got your mortality improvement underestimated by, say, 1% every year, what would that do to your bottom line?
Yeah. One other thing to add on the capital point is, I suppose, as certain people, as our peer reviewer quite rightly pointed out, actually, Kent Hopper, capital depends a little bit on, you know, it's a company-wide view. So one aspect to consider in terms of capital is in terms of what other risks do you have on your books? So from a holistic risk management view, what other risks are on your books and how do they correlate or not correlate to longevity risk? So one of the reasons why, so we both, no coincidence, we both work for Swiss Re. One reason that Swiss Re and other large reinsurers may be keen on longevity risk is they have a lot of mortality risk. And of course, mortality risk is at younger ages, longevity risk is at older ages, but there's still some sort of negative correlations between the two in the sense that if there's a pandemic or some of the period effects affect all ages, and you do get some diversification benefits from that. So one issue in Australia is that if you look at the mortality business in Australia, it's typically short term, non guaranteed, and I suppose you'd question whether if there were long term mortality improvements in Australia, would you actually enjoy the benefits of that on your mortality portfolio, or would you just lower the rates for the in-force policyholders or be forced to come down on rates. But for us, I guess we have a lot of guaranteed mortality books, especially in the US and the UK, which are written on a level term basis or a whole life basis, where I suppose there's less chance of sort of lapse and re-entry problems. So we do see this as a useful way of diversifying. And longevity is a sort of risk that doesn't really diversify that well between countries. If there's something that causes mortality to improve a lot in Australia, chances are, if there's like a super drug or something like that, or some sort of super medical advance, chances are it'll apply to all developed countries. And so there's not so much diversification benefit that way. But I've got off the topic of what you were asking, but I hope between myself and Patricia we covered what you were looking for.
Okay, I might use chairman's privilege to throw in a couple of comments as well on, you know, profitability. I think one of the interesting things about extending timeframes is it actually does progressively reduce the risk of writing a lifetime annuity. The problem with getting a life expectancy 10% wrong, say, is much lower if you've got, you know, a 20-year, 30-year life expectancy versus 10. If you consider your ultimate case of a perpetuity, then, you know, you don't have to hold any capital for the longevity risk. And as you extend it out, your risk is actually going down, which I guess I find interesting. And given where some of the, expectations might be at the moment, I've played around with a few numbers, and I think that, depending, of course, on what your return on capital is, you can actually have some material moves in mortality and still make a return on capital. You might dust 10% or something like that. But if you've got less than 10%, that's going to lead to a loss. But I think most people have return hurdles over that. So you're still in positive return on equity territory. even with some very material movements in mortality. Anyway, there you go. Just very easy to work it out. Any other questions or comments?
Duncan Rawlinson, just a question following up on the point about postcode pricing. An observation and a question. The UK postcode system is very different from the Australian postcode system. So, you know, you can... The full English postcode will give you a residence, maybe one amongst 50 houses, maybe even less than that. So, you know, the first part of a postcode system is perhaps more analogous to the four-digit system that we use in Australia. So can you just clarify that when you said insurers in the UK are using postcode, I mean, you know, give me an example. You could, BH89EJ, my old postcode in the UK. BH8 is like a sort of four-digit code here. So the 9EJ says exactly what road, what little collection of houses, and you can deliver, a postman can deliver to a postcode virtually rather than how they do it here. So when they're using postcode pricing in the UK, is it at the sort of level of the four-digit postcodes we have in Australia, or is it down at a particular road and which side of the road you live on, and they're trying to punt on whether you're north-facing or south-facing, and therefore some suggestion as to what occupation class you might have originated from?
It tends to be the first, I think, three or four digits, which tells you the locality, because, it basically follows the level of data you have for mortality, so it's sort of down to around local council district, that sort of level. So it is almost around the sort of level that Australian postcodes are at, maybe around that sort of similar level. One other thing about the UK is a lot of the there are. So getting back to Tony's question about can you buy an investment property in a poor suburb and get a better annuity rate, for example? The postcode pricing is used for individual annuities, but I guess you can argue that it's more useful for some of these block pension transfers. So if you know where, if you got a block of pensioners from a particular company, and you know that most of them live in this area, or some of them live in this area, some of them live in this area, that may be a more useful or more stable or robust way of using postcode pricing. For individual pricing, I guess it's an interesting idea, and you can see loopholes in it, and on average maybe it works, but it's still far from a sort of proven and stable relationship.
Can I ask you? Sorry. Yep. I know when it was first mooted, there were some letters, I think I remember reading, from professional people living in Glasgow who were going to get particularly unduly favourable annuity prices, and similarly whinges from manual labourers who might live in the southeast that were going to come out unfavourably. So I guess picking up on Tony's point, are there any insights you can give as to what is it commonly accepted practice now? Is there a groundswell of negative reaction to insurers' attempts to get to this basis of pricing for annuities in the UK?
I'm not really completely up to speed on what the situation is at the moment. I understand it's not that everyone has introduced it yet, so it is quite early days in terms of. There are some pioneers out there who are using it and think they get an advantage out of it because they pick up more of the lower socioeconomic classes and less of the higher socioeconomic classes. But I think the jury's still out on whether it will become sort of the de facto standard for the UK.
Further questions? Oh, well, I might ask one while we're here. I guess a lot of the discussion has been on the through time selection effect, so the overall portfolio. Obviously, there's a that you've got people who are buying an annuity who think, you know, I'm from good stock, my grandmother lived to 98 or whatever it happens to be. But then, of course, people at the time they're buying the annuity have current information. Do you have a view on that, you know, upfront selection effect and how it wears off over time?
The question is about the selection, self-select impact on the experience. One thing that we noticed that you rather have the self-select impact at the earlier post-retirement age than in the 80s, because if you have a 50% selection impact for a 60-year-old. The variability, just by quantum, is much less than a 50% variability for an 80-year-old in terms of mortality. And so, in terms of the long, it's very long-term annuity lifetime pricing. So, in the whole scheme of things, the self-select impact on the first order is very much just in the first few years. So, in a way, you really want to make sure that you've got the tail end right. In terms of the ages in the 80s, this is where the bulk of the mortalities will happen. But then, obviously, of course, and then you have another effect is very much a lifestyle, social economic class effect again. That those people that chose to buy annuities on a voluntary basis tend to have better lifestyle, more educated. Then that impact on mortality probably will be more persistent over the years.
Just echo that. Yeah, at age 65, selection is not that big an issue, especially a lot of companies have an initial guarantee period, which further dilutes some of that selection effect. But selection, I don't know. Selection is a bit hard to tell. Actually, if you use the UK data, selection is a little bit misleading because the UK market, there's some element of compulsory annuitisation in the UK. I think you have to take 66, effectively 67% of your retirement income as a pension. So there is some form of compulsion. So the UK data is probably not as select as a fully self-select market would be. But the US data, I think Patricia had some US data as well. The US is a sort of fully voluntary market and maybe is a bit more representative of what you would get in a fully select population. I don't know, it's a little bit like selection on mortality business. If you're a US actuary, you think it lasts 15 or 20 years. If you're a UK actuary, you think it lasts 5 years maybe at most. It's a little bit difficult to tell, I guess, with the data that you have available, especially with some of these sort of cohort improvement factors and things like that. Is your observed selection effect really a selection effect, or is it a cohort effect or something like that?
Terrific. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for attending. Can I ask you to thank Patricia and Lawrence, and I have some gifts for them from the Institute.